Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Former Fox News star Bill O'Reilly paid out millions to settle sexual harassment allegations from female colleagues. Some of the settlements are now public, and the details are striking. Meanwhile, President Trump says he knows nothing about a secret six-figure payment to one Stormy Daniels. Who does such secrecy serve, the accusers or the accused? This hour on Point, Bill O'Reilly, the Me Too movement, and the future of the nondisclosure agreement. You can join us on air or online. Now that these settlements are public, what do you make of all that money Bill O'Reilly paid to keep his accusers quiet? What about all the money other high-profile men have paid out? What about the money these women have accepted? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Emily Steele. She covers the media industry for the New York Times, but has been doing a lot of investigating lately. Early last year, she broke the story uncovering a series of settlements and sexual harassment allegations involving Bill O'Reilly, and she's been following the story ever since. Emily, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So Bill O'Reilly fought really, really hard to keep these settlements out of public view. Who did they involve, and how did they actually come to light?
Right. So what we now know is that there have been at least six settlements involving allegations against Bill O'Reilly, and that the total amount of payments for those settlements is $45 million. Last week, some of those settlements came into public view, and we got to see exactly the details that were used to keep those documents and those allegations and those agreements private.
So let's drill down a little bit here. First off, let's mention who it is who was challenging O'Reilly in court to over these settlements and over putting them in public view. And then let's talk a little bit about some of the items and disclosures embedded in there. What surprised you most?
So there are now four women, but there are in this particular case, there are three women who had reached confidentiality agreements with Bill O'Reilly and Fox News over allegations against him. One is a woman named Andrea Macris. She brought forward this very public lawsuit in 2004 where she made allegations of sexual harassment against Bill O'Reilly. That suit later settled for $9 million. The second woman is a woman named Rebecca Gomez-Diamond, who was a regular contributor on Fox Business. She made complaints and made allegations against Bill O'Reilly in 2011 and reached a confidential agreement at that time. And then the third is this woman, Rachel Whitley Bernstein, who worked as a young producer at Fox News and made harassment allegations against O'Reilly and reached a settlement with him and with the network as well. Those women, we reported on all of those agreements last April in this big New York Times investigation that exposed this record of settlements involving O'Reilly and how the network, how the company had continued to protect him over the course of his tenure at Fox News.
And knowing that there had been payments.
Knowing that there had been payments that we now know total at least $45 million.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, yeah.
Emily, for that money, he was able to get some things, right? He said he got to keep it quiet. But he also embedded in there, particularly in the Macris case, there seemed to be a number of pretty surprising elements that you highlighted in your coverage. Point to those for me. Which ones stand out for you?
Right. So what we learned last week is that there were some previously unknown details about these tactics that were deployed to really keep these women quiet. And these were these women. These women had serious sexual harassment allegations against O'Reilly. So some of the terms of those agreements included turning over all evidence, including audio recordings and O'Reilly and diaries to Mr. O'Reilly. The women also... One of the women was required to say that if those materials ever became public, that they were counterfeit and forgeries.
That is to say that they would effectively say that their own allegations had been lies.
Well, it would be if what we now know is that a couple of these women who had made allegations, who had reached these settlements with O'Reilly, that they had made recordings of conversations that they had had with him. Mm-hmm. In the midst of this settlement, they were required to turn those tapes over to O'Reilly. And what the agreements say is that if those tapes ever were to become public, that the women needed to deny their truthfulness, their validity.
And that would have been the lie right there, essentially. They had negotiated that. There was also an element that said, if I recall correctly, that the lawyer for one of the women, Andrea Macris, switched sides. How did that work?
Right. So this is one of the things that we found to be really, really interesting. So as part of the agreement with Andrea Macris, her lawyers agreed to provide legal advice to Mr. O'Reilly on sexual harassment matters and also agreed not to represent other parties with sexual harassment claims against Mr. O'Reilly or Fox News in the future. And that's a very significant statement. We've talked to legal experts who've said that those arrangements are considered unethical because they create conflicts of interest between the lawyers and their clients. And they also can sideline lawyers who have expertise to bring these claims against companies or individuals.
Speaking of lawyers, so we contacted Fred Newman. He's one of Bill O'Reilly's attorneys. He said in a statement to On Point that, quote, the only reason Bill O'Reilly settled any cases was to protect his children, which is a point that O'Reilly's made publicly. The lawyer went on to say the settlement agreements were fully negotiated by these plaintiffs, ably represented by experienced counsel. He talked about O'Reilly's respect that he said that he had over the confidentiality of the settlement agreements for the past 14 years. And then he concludes, but now that the provision has been breached, Mr. O'Reilly will be taking all of the appropriate legal action to enforce the agreements. I think it's worth putting in contrast to that some of the statements Bill O'Reilly has made publicly where he says that he hasn't talked about these things. Last September, O'Reilly appeared on the Today Show with Matt Lauer, who has since resigned himself over sexual harassment allegations from his own network. Lauer grilled O'Reilly on the allegations against him. We have a cut of that right here.
Look, anything's possible, all right? But it goes to credibility, doesn't it? All right? If you look at the in totality, this was a hit job, a political and financial hit job.
A hit job. On September 17th, O'Reilly appeared on Fox anchor Sean Hannity's radio program, where he accused plaintiffs and lawsuits against him of what he called shocking defamation against him.
We're going to be very precise, and it's not going to be any he said, she said, not going to be any of that. It's going to be facts, cold stone facts. And what we're going to uncover, because we're already pretty well down this road, is shocking. That's the only word I can use. Shocking.
And
that this could happen in our republic, that this kind of defamation, and it's bought and paid for, as you pointed out, millions of dollars in play. It's shocking.
So in this instance, you have circumstances where O'Reilly didn't attack any of the women challenging him in court currently by name, but he certainly seemed to be assailing motivations, calling accusations against him defamation, saying it's a political and financial hit job. Where do things now stand with that case?
Right. So now there are four women who have reached settlements over allegations against O'Reilly. And what they have said in their lawsuits, three of the women filed a lawsuit in December, another one filed one more recently, is that those public statements by O'Reilly in the aftermath of our investigation that exposed this record of allegations of abuse, the women have said that those statements from O'Reilly have depicted them as liars and politically motivated women who were extortionists, who were out to shake him down and who were out to get his money. And right now, these cases are kind of in the midst of the legal system. Part of the reason why the settlements became public last week is because, as part of his defense, as part of his reason why these suits should be moved to arbitration, should be moved to dismissal, O'Reilly has used he's cited the confidentiality agreements. He's mm-hmm. cited those settlements in his defense. And so lawyers for the women said that because of that, these settlements should become public. They should be part of the court of law. They should be out in the open. And a judge last week said that there was no reason to keep them private and that they should be public. And so that's where we are now.
Let's take a call from Jim in Lexington, South Carolina. Jim, go right ahead.
Hi, David. I just wanted to make a comment about these women that are taking money, like Stormy Daniels.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
well,
sir.
Well, you know, if they really had any dignity, I don't think they would be taking the money. And leads me to believe they're being sexually provocative. You know, in Stormy Daniels' case, of course, she literally sells herself out. And
Stormy Daniels, of course, a pornographic actress who appears in a lot of movies and online. You're saying that by accepting money for these settlements, these women are doing what, sir?
I mean, I'm saying in Stormy Daniels' case in particular, she's literally selling herself out. And the point I wanted to make is, why should we not think that she's getting paid even more money now to come out with these allegations against Trump?
Jim, thank you so much for your call, and we will be turning a little bit to the case involving Stormy Daniels and President Trump a bit later in the hour. But Emily, briefly, in your reporting, have you found any instances in which it appeared as though women seemed pretty happy to keep their silence and keep their accusations and circumstances to themselves in exchange for a significant payout from people like Bill O'Reilly?
You know, so what we've learned in the course of our reporting over the past year or so is that what typically happens in these situations is a woman doesn't usually come forward with these claims because, number one, she's afraid that nobody will believe her. If she does come forward with the claims, what typically happens is she'll approach a lawyer. The lawyer will contact the company or the individual that she mm-hmm. has claims against. The two sides come to some sort of agreement, and often often there's money exchanged, and in exchange for that money, there's silence. And
that's the cement
kind of
that holds the deal together,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Emily Steele of The New York Times, please stand by and stay with us this hour. We're discussing the newly public details of the settlements Bill O'Reilly's attorney struck with two of the women, several of the women, who accused him of sexual harassment. You can join our conversation. Is it time to end these confidential non-disclosure agreements? Is it important to keep them? Do you question motivation on either side? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA, the podcast that takes you inside the Latino conversation. Each week, we'll take you into one story that will fascinate and often surprise you. Listen to Latino USA on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the newly public details of the settlements that Bill O'Reilly made with women who accused him of sexual harassment and about the legal future of non-disclosure agreements in general. You can join the conversation. Can non-disclosure agreements, that is confidential agreements, allow targets of sexual harassment a measure of privacy? Or are they just a device to keep accusers silent? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest is Emily Steele. She covers the media industry for the New York Times, and her reporting uncovered this series of settlements related to sexual harassment allegations against Bill O'Reilly. And joining me now from Montclair, New Jersey, is Nancy Erica Smith. She's an employment attorney, and she represented former Fox News host Gretchen Carlson in her sexual harassment lawsuit against the late Fox News CEO Roger Ailes, among other clients. Nancy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. Nice to be here.
Nancy, you're also the lawyer representing the women in the cases we've just been talking about, alleging, as I understand it, that O'Reilly violated the confidentiality of those settlements by saying that the accusations were lies, that saying he was defamed. He didn't name your clients. Why was it important to challenge him in court on that?
Well, there were five women named in the April 1st, 2017 article by Emily Steele and Michael Schmidt in the New York Times. That's a small identifiable group. They were named by name in the article. So when Bill O'Reilly started talking a year ago and one name was added in October, so we're talking about a small identifiable group of six women, clearly he was talking about our clients. You can't claim, oh, I wasn't talking about the sexual harassment, the other people I sexually harassed or who accused me of sexually harassing them, you being sexually harassed, when there's an identifiable small group. And the law is very clear on this.
Hey, Nancy, we're going to do something here. We're going to call you back and try to clarify your line right away. And I'll talk to Emily for a moment and we'll get you right back online, okay? Emily, one question I had from the kinds of issues that Nancy is raising in court and on the line here, but also raised in your coverage, is the question of what we've learned about Fox more broadly, and what, if anything, has changed there since the kinds of stories that we've seen, both about Roger Ailes, but also about Bill O'Reilly.
Right. So it's been very fascinating to look just at how that network has or has not changed in the more than a year and a half since Gretchen Carlson first came forward with this public lawsuit against Roger Ailes, the founding chairman of Fox News. In the months that followed, the Murdochs said that they were committed to creating a workplace based on trust and respect, and they made a number of initiatives designed to create a workplace that that people felt valued and that they wouldn't face harassment. But in the months that followed, we continued to do our reporting and we continued to dig up details about these number of settlements involving Bill O'Reilly. And what our reporting showed is that it wasn't just O'Reilly. It wasn't just a number of settlements and a number of allegations against him, but there was this entire system of protection that went up to the highest levels of 21st Century Fox, which is the parent company of Fox News, designed to protect him. And it was only after the settlements and the allegations against him became public that there was an advertising boycott against him, that there were protests in the streets of New York City, that the company decided that it was time to let him go. We've seen the company kind of go through a number of efforts in the months since then to really try to clean up the workplace. They've brought in a new HR head. They have done a number of workshops and trainings and the like. And I think the jury really still is out to see whether and how that company and that network has changed. I think there is another big interesting question to think about and that should be asked is what's happened to these women that have come forward with the stories against powerful men and what have become of their lives? And what we've seen, and there was a really smart article in the Columbia Journalism Review about this, is that a number of the women who have come forward with allegations against powerful men are not in the jobs that they chose, are not working in the industry that was their chosen career path.
I'm grateful to say Nancy Erica Smith is back online with us from Montclair, New Jersey. Nancy, I want to just reiterate a little bit of the question and move it forward a bit. Why was it important for you to challenge in court what O'Reilly had said, given he hadn't named your clients. And also, tell me a little bit, you also allege that that Rupert Murdoch, who's acting as the CEO of Fox News, but also as the head controlling owner of its parent company, that he himself, in a sense, defamed your clients as well. Cast some light on that for us.
Sure. Well, my three clients are part of a very small identifiable group of women. So you can't say you didn't defame somebody by saying I didn't say their name if the public can quickly recognize who you're talking about. So it's not important that Bill O'Reilly didn't say my clients' names. Everybody knows that he's referring to the April 1, 2017 article. And he's talking about these women who complained about him. Two, Rupert Murdoch called the claims nonsense and said that except for a problem with the chief executive, meaning Roger Ailes, isolated incidents, the rest of it was nonsense and it's a bit of flirting. Sexual harassment isn't flirting. And it's defamatory to call what my clients went through nonsense. And this violates the very arbitration clause. There, you know, now that O'Reilly's gone around for a year defaming three women, five women really, but three of my clients, and calling them politically and financially motivated. Their claims are unfounded. They're defaming him. It's a political hit job. Mm-hmm. All of these statements clearly say that my clients didn't raise in good faith sexual harassment claims and then settle them. So he's gone around for a year doing that. Then when we sue him for defamation, he files a public motion. And in that motion, he quotes a statement that Andrea Mack was forced to make in her settlement agreement, that it's a joint statement that no wrongdoing occurred. So Bill O'Reilly's lawyers go to court and say she admits there was no wrongdoing, quoting the actual settlement agreement. That's why the settlement agreements became public, because they're relevant to why that statement was issued, what position Andrea Macris had been put in by Fox and Bill O'Reilly, them getting her lawyer to simultaneously turn into his lawyer. Incredible provisions in the settlement agreement that really show how NDAs have been used really to further the abuse of women. It's bad enough you get harassed. Now you're going to shut up and we're going to make you lie.
You know, I want to talk about the nondisclosure agreements. You weren't the lawyer when these deals were struck for these clients now. You're saying the effects of the confidentiality agreements were to defend those against whom accusations were made, it sounds like. What was the larger effect of this this veil being cast over these private accusations?
The larger effect is that it's allowed serial sexual harassers to stay in the workplace and continue to harass women. It's like putting women in front of a moving train. Fox knew that he was a harasser, and they allowed him to continue harassing by shutting up other women. Women are empowered when they know they're not alone. It's very scary, for instance, to come out and accuse Roger Ailes of sexual harassment. He's a powerful and famous person. But when other women started being empowered and coming forward, it changed things. And we see that in the Me Too movement with Harvey Weinstein. The only way that we are going to change this world and stop sexual harassment is the light of day. And that has become abundantly clear thanks to journalism. So that's the only way. So NDAs enable serial sexual harassers. My clients do not ask for NDAs. And not having an NDA doesn't mean your client has to talk about the harassment. It doesn't require it, and the harasser certainly isn't going to do it. But requiring women to shut up about their own harassment is just another form of abuse.
There's a comment on our website from a poster who identifies as Gregors, asks, NDA, would these be enforceable if the action in question was homicide or robbery or insider trading? Nancy, you've said in the past that you kind of like to do away with the privacy clauses of the NDAs, the nondisclosure agreement element of these kinds of settlements. That is, there should be the wrongs addressed but not a silence enforced. Doesn't that in some way get rid of a lot of the leverage that women have in certain kinds of cases to bring these to a resolution they can in some ways live with?
No, I don't believe that at all. I don't believe that, one, women are selling silence. We shouldn't be selling silence. That's not what we're doing. We're trying to get rid of sexual harassment. If we shine the light of day, maybe employers will start firing the wrongdoer instead of the victim, which is what I've seen happen for 38 years. For 38 years, my client is the one that leaves the workplace, not the harasser. And silence is what allows that. And then they are there to harass again. Now, if you're saying, do some lawyers maybe take cases that aren't too meritorious and settle for a little amount of money to buy silence, they may. That shouldn't be the public policy. That shouldn't be how we solve this problem. The light of day is clearly making a change. We can see it. We can see what's happening. So, no, I don't agree that it's going to be harder to settle. And it doesn't matter. I'm happy to try these cases. Let's try these cases in front of juries. Let's put the facts out there. Most real sexual harassment cases, the employer is still going to do better by not having a week-long or two-week-long trial where we play these tapes and these videos.
And that was certainly seemed to be some of the impetus in the settlement of Gretchen Carlson's lawsuit. In that case, a reported $20 million settlement in her harassment charges against former Fox News CEO and the late Roger Ailes. That's Nancy Erica Smith. She's joined us from Montclair, New Jersey. Nancy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Emily, let's talk about this because, you know, you mentioned about ways in which Fox has cleaned house and how it's appointed new executives and brought in new figures. A bunch of executives have left. In some ways, they were accused of enabling harassment. In other cases, in certain instances, they were accused of their own wrongdoing. The host, Eric Bolling, left, although he disputes the rightness of that. James Rosen left after accusations of sexual harassment were raised by some of his colleagues down at the Washington Bureau of Fox News. How transparent is Fox about these issues these days, and how much do you think people there feel confident that the leadership takes this issue seriously as opposed to wants to be seen as taking this issue seriously?
Well, what I think is really extraordinary to think about is, and we kind of talked about this before a little bit, but after Roger Ailes was ousted from the network in the wake of this very public sexual harassment scandal at Fox News, in the wake of this public lawsuit that had been filed by Gretchen Carlson, this former Fox News host, against Roger Ailes, the company committed to creating a workplace based on trust and respect. But in the months that followed, I talked to several current and former employees from the network who said that there still were issues. There still were a number of men in positions of power there that they had allegations against. And it didn't necessarily seem like things had changed. And what had happened in the spring of last year, or it was at this time last year, is the company had said that it was committed to creating a workplace based on trust and respect, but at the same time was defending Bill O'Reilly after the New York Times, our investigation that exposed this record of allegations against him and how the company had protected him. And so that's a huge culture. That's a system of protection. It's a system of silence. It's a system where women said that they feared coming forward with complaints. They feared that making allegations against other people at the company would jeopardize their jobs. It's a huge thing to change. And I think we're in the midst of seeing that, and we're in the midst of seeing whether that's even possible.
Sure. You know, it's important to note in these circumstances, of course, Matt Lauer was forced out of NBC News after severe accusations there. Charlie Rose at CBS and PBS, the former top news executive at NPR, also a part of this litany of major figures. I want to go to Madison, Wisconsin. We have Jen standing by on the line. Jen, what do you have to say on this?
Hi, David. I just wanted to kind of respond to what one of the other callers had brought up, but kind of touching into some of the issues your guests have been discussing, and that when people imply that the sexual histories of these accusers is somehow relevant is really perplexing to me, and especially as a young woman, it's really concerning that people would say that just because a person has engaged you know, consensually in some sort of activity outside of the workplace, that somehow she's no longer able to say no to certain advances mm-hmm. in the workplace is just, it's, I think, an issue that needs to be discussed and it needs to be confronted. And it's really troublesome to hear people point to the histories of women that has absolutely nothing to do with this case. Absolutely nothing to do with how this
sure.
workplace.
So thank you for that call, Jen. And few better to address that than Deborah Katz, who's joining me down from the line in Washington. Deborah is a civil rights and employment attorney at the firm Katz, Marshall & Banks. She's handled a lot of sexual harassment. Deborah, cases, I should say. Deborah, in just a minute before we go to a brief break, sketch out for me how seriously you think women are taken in your perspective since the outbreak of the Me Too movement, since the questions about Harvey Weinstein and Roger Ailes and others have come to the forefront of American consciousness?
Well, there's obviously been a sea change. There's a tremendous change in terms of how employers respond to these allegations. There is no longer the presumption that women are liars and trying to game the system. And for women, there is much more of a sense that if they come forward, they will be believed. There's still a fear of retaliation, but there's been a real shift here. And employers do not want to be the next person featured by Emily in her articles. So mm-hmm. there is much more of an effort to resolve these cases without first trying to smear the person who's brought them forward.
Deb and Emily, if you don't mind standing by for the next segment, we're discussing the legal future of non-disclosure agreements in sexual harassment settlements. You can join in on our conversation. Do non-disclosure agreements harm accusers, or are they necessary to protect them? We'd love for you to join us. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
It's Lulu Miller, and I am back with a new story for Invisibilia. It is about the pleasures.
It's just electric.
And the dangers.
There's just nothing more scary.
Of trying to live between two worlds. You can find Invisibilia on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about what's next for non-disclosure agreements in sexual harassment settlements. You can join the conversation. Should non-disclosure agreements be banned outright, or is there a way to reduce potential harm while keeping them in place? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests this hour, Emily Steele, who covers the media industry for The New York Times, and Deborah Katz, a civil rights and employment lawyer in Washington. I want to turn for just a sec to a couple of comments we got from our website. There's someone posting under the name George84 Orwell, as if we needed to know the numbers. The allegations against O'Reilly are coming out because the hashtag MeToo shaming movement needs more stories to stay alive. A poster under the name Katie counters, I don't think you should be able to buy yourself out of criminal charges in this society where the wealth gap is obvious. The idea that the rich always walk and the poor are used as a revenue source sickens me. Why hasn't Bill had to suffer? I think Bill O'Reilly has argued in many forums that he's suffered greatly and that he's only been paying these out to protect his family. Some of his accusers would offer a very different tale. Deb Katz, you have sued companies and pressured companies on behalf of clients who allege they've been subjected to sexual harassment claims. But you've told me you're not opposed to non-disclosure agreements. How come?
That's true. Non-disclosure agreements in sexual harassment cases that are negotiated with appropriate equal bargaining power in the negotiations are really something that employers will require to get a case settled. And I differ from what Nancy said in your last segment. Getting rid of the ability of individuals to agree to NDAs as a condition of settlement takes away a really crucial part of their bargaining power. That is one thing that less powerful individuals can give as a condition of settlement. Now, I think that what we see in the Bill O'Reilly settlements are egregious abuses. He has required people to lie, to destroy evidence. He has required recantation documents. All of that's just despicable. Those are absolutely inappropriate and unethical tactics. I don't think any lawyer should agree to that. There are bar rules that prohibit that. But the idea of not allowing individuals who want to settle their cases quietly and move on with their lives and saying this class of individuals cannot do that will hurt my clients. And I'm opposed to that.
Let's take a call from Miami, Florida, from William. William on line one, go right ahead.
Hi, Dave. I'm basically calling because, you know, I see it as a more of a simple thing here. If women really wanted to change the game, or certain women, I can't say all the women, but if certain women wanted to really change the game, don't accept a settlement. Go through with the proceedings, go to court, prosecute the sexual offender, and basically, you know, make sure that he goes to jail and don't accept any money for it. But once you accept money, in my opinion, and it's only an opinion, you know, that's grounds for you to stay quiet because you're getting paid for that.
Well, William, thank you for your opinion. Deb Katz, you handle these things in and out of court. What about that? If you're not taking these issues to court, if they're not ventilated in the light of day, how are underlying issues addressed? How do we know what patterns of behavior exist?
Well, first of all, I just disagree with the premise of the caller. We have sexual harassment laws that protect people and give them a cause of action, a right to seek legal compensation if they suffer workplace discrimination, including sexual harassment. And these individuals are not threatening people without real claims and shaking people down. And these individuals did not come forward and violate the settlement agreements that they entered into. Bill O'Reilly violated the settlement agreements by essentially saying that these people were extortionists and that they were liars. And he violated his end of the bargain.
You think that's pretty clear cut?
It seems to me very clear cut. But the reality is most individuals who have been harmed in the workplace, whether it be sexual harassment, race discrimination, or any other form of illegal discrimination, do not want to become permanent litigants for life. It is very costly. It is exhausting psychically, emotionally. People can't move on. And the idea that somehow women have to who have been victimized at work have to sue to prove to the public that the bona fides of their allegations I disagree with that. Like any other litigant, they can resolve their claims. And if these weren't serious allegations, we would not have in the aggregate $45 million of settlements paid, nor would we have had agreements to return and destroy evidence. Obviously, that condition shows that there's evidence.
So let's turn to another forum in which non-disclosure agreements have arisen and some light appears to be being shed on them. Back in January, the pornographic actress Stormy Daniels deflected questions about her rumored affair with President Trump when she was appearing on Jimmy Kimmel Live. She was asked about whether she had a non-disclosure agreement with Trump, and Kimmel kept poking holes and teasing her a little bit to try to get her to answer the question. We have that clip here.
Do you have a non-disclosure agreement?
Do I?
You can't say whether you have a non-disclosure agreement, but if you didn't have a non-disclosure agreement, you most certainly could say, I don't have a non-disclosure agreement. Yes?
You're so smart, Jimmy.
Thank you very much. Okay.
So a little, deductive or inductive reasoning, take your pick there about the existence of such a thing. Emily Steele, when you see reports about the non-disclosure agreement that Stormy Daniels is said to have had with the president through his attorney, it is not a case where there has been an allegation of sexual harassment or sexual assault. She has described their encounters as consensual. And at the same time, it seems as though there was an effort to pay off to keep unwanted allegations out of public view. What do you take from looking at this, given the kinds of reporting that you've been doing for the past 15, 18 months?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really interesting. I've seen a number of these agreements now in the course of my reporting, and there are a number of similarities. There are these requirements for silence. There are the non-disparagement and non-disclosure agreements included. There is typically a payment in many of the cases. It's spread out over a number of years to ensure someone's silence. And there's also, you can, when you look at them, you can kind of deduce what the original allegations or the original claims were by looking at some of the terms of the agreement. So in agreements with O'Reilly, with at least three of them that I've seen, there were requirements that the evidence would be handed over, whether those were tapes or diaries or video journals, or that that evidence would be destroyed. So there's a lot of similarities here when you start looking at these documents.
Does it make sense to have such to strike such agreements if one can find ways to unravel them with, you know, what clearly the people in the Trump camp or people in the O'Reilly camp see as technicalities?
You know, I think that's a question that many lawyers might be asking now. There's kind of two different ways you can think about this. Is on one hand, if these NDAs can be unraveled and they were there to really try to ensure silence and protect the protect the parties that this information won't come out, then there are real questions about kind of the effectiveness of these NDAs. On the other hand, it took a tremendous amount of reporting on behalf of the New York Times. I spent months upon months upon months and talked to dozens of people to really try to get at what were the allegations, what were the claims, what were these agreements. And so it's not like most all of these NDAs are all of a sudden becoming exposed in public in light of this Me Too movement. There's still a huge wall of silence around a lot of this information.
We have a caller from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Chris is on line one. Chris, I believe you have your own story to tell.
Yes. I have been in the media for years. I had serious sexual harassment against me.
Uh-huh.
I filed a lawsuit, settled for $100,000. But part of my agreement was that the person would never, ever do such a thing. And my lawyers would monitor him. I used part of that money, and it is being used to monitor him for 10 years.
So it's.
But I want to make a point.
Yes, ma'am.
No one has stated that women have been afraid to bring actions against men because men have dominated all professions, and if they bring any sort of action whatsoever in all professions, they can't get jobs.
Chris, I want to thank you for sharing this story and your own experiences here. We have the account also of a former Fox News anchor, Juliette Huddy. She recently was interviewed by Megyn Kelly. Huddy accused herself, Bill O'Reilly, of sexual harassment and talked in this appearance about her fear of standing up for herself. She ultimately signed a non-disclosure agreement after reaching a settlement with Fox.
Women who have to deal with this type of stuff, it's everything you said is so true. The fear of lawyers, no offense, you know, going up against corporate attorneys, you know, people who are trained at Harvard and educated at Yale and Oxford. And you know that you're just this one person that's about to go up against literally a machine. And it is daunting and it's frightening. And it holds you back from taking action sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Megyn Kelly herself, not just a lawyer, but a former Fox News host and anchor who herself accused the late Roger Ailes of sexually harassing her earlier in her career when she was a young reporter. Deb Katz, sketch out for us what it would look like for sort of what you would see as a healthy version of NDAs and a process that would ensure the public or at least a workforce would have an understanding that somebody had been perhaps accused more than once of such inappropriate behavior, and at the same time protecting what you see as a value to the kinds of women you've represented in the past in having some of that information be kept confidential.
Well, that is the big question. Let me back up for one second, which is one of the instruments that employers use to really muzzle people in the workplace is NDAs as a condition of employment. And we saw this in the Weinstein case, that just to get a job there, you had to agree to an NDA. We know the Trump Organization does that. It's not designed to protect legitimate, confidential, trade secret information of an employer, but it's designed to muzzle people and to make employees feel that if they speak out about workplace abuses, they can be sued. We have to get rid of that. And there are laws being offered at the state levels to just make those kind of provisions completely improper and disallow them. And I wholeheartedly support those efforts. There's no legitimate reason to have them. In terms of the NDAs as a condition of settlement, that's a more complicated question because I do believe it takes away the bargaining power of less powerful parties. So one thing I think that tries to strike the balance is a law that New York passed, which disallows NDAs except at the election of the victim. So employers would be prohibited from requiring it unless the victim of harassment also agreed to it. And in cases that I've been involved in, my clients are just as interested in buying silence as the other side is. So that gives the victim of harassment the election. Why? Because they don't want the name of Bill O'Reilly Googled and have their name pop up too. They don't want to be perpetually associated with really bad periods of their lives. They don't want that. I respect their desire to move on with their life and not be perceived with that. And you can even tell by the calls we've had this morning that the presumption is that if somebody settles and takes money, that somehow they're just trying to game a system. So people don't want that. And the other real aspect is when you're associated with a sexual harassment case, no matter how meritorious, the next employer is not going to want to hire you. So there are ongoing knock-on effects of being associated with sexual harassment claims, even the most meritorious of claims. So I think that the effort to ban them altogether is not going to be good for my clients, and it may make people not even want to come forward to assert claims if they know at the end of the day that the allegations will be made public.
Emily, you focused a lot on the media. It is, after all, your beat, but you've been doing a lot of investigative reporting. Why do you think ultimately so much of this has focused in and on the media? Do you think there's something different about it, or do you think we're just closer to it because we're all reporters? I got to say, it's a question that comes up in every newsroom I visit.
One of the things that I've learned in the past 18 months of all of this reporting is just how much sexual harassment is about power. It is about sex, but it also is about power. And I think what we see in the media industry is a number of powerful men who've kind of risen to these positions where they make millions and millions and millions of dollars a year. And they're almost kind of seen as untouchable. And I think with that, we've seen a number of allegations of abuse against those powerful men. But I also want to add is that this isn't just an issue with the media industry. It's really an issue that's pervasive across our society. And the Times' coverage has really exposed a number of different industries where women have voiced concerns about facing harassment, whether it's restaurant workers or the auto workers at a plant at Ford in Chicago. And so what we've really seen is that this isn't just the media. It isn't just these powerful men that you see on TV, but it's really something that's pervasive in our society. But what I think was really important is that the media industry does have this sense of celebrity, and there is this sense of powerful men that the world knows and the world sees. And when those allegations became public against those men, it really made the world pay attention.
Well, we've been talking with two people who in different ways are leading figures understanding this issue, helping us to come to terms with it. Emily Steele covers the media industry for The New York Times. Her reporting uncovered the series of settlements related to sexual harassment allegations against Bill O'Reilly in early 2017. Emily, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Deborah Katz is a civil rights and employment attorney at the firm Katz, Marshall & Banks in Washington. Deborah, we really appreciate your taking time this hour.
Oh, thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.